Hello and welcome to Africa Now. In this show, we explore the brutal farm killings in South Africa that often go unreported by the world's media. In the last 6 weeks, 8 farmers have been murdered in the country, which means that each week at least one farmer is being killed in South Africa. But that statistic only tells half the story. For every farmer murdered, there are 57 attacks, according to watchdogs in South Africa. The survivors of those attacks are forced to spend the rest of their lives reliving the nightmares, brutality, and torture of their ordeal. Here are some of their stories.
I came home from school after dropping my daughter and I opened the gate. I drove in, I got out, and I closed the gate again. After locking the gate with a padlock and a chain, when I walked back to my bucky, the two suspects came running out of the millies. They were about 10 meters away from me, but as soon as I saw them, they were already on top of me. I started screaming. They had a cattle prodder. Both of them grabbed me on my neck and they tried to choke me. I almost passed out and they said to me, if I keep quiet, then they'll let me go. They won't strangle me anymore. Both of them grabbed me like this. I was back like this, so I couldn't see everything, but both of them had their hands around my neck and they drove me into the house. They told me to open with the keys. They forced me to open up for them. The main guy, the boss guy, he kept threatening that if I don't cooperate, then he's going to shoot me. This is the passage where they made me lie down. I had to lie here so that I couldn't see outside. This one was my daughter's room, the one that's staying with me. They ransacked everything as well. Went through all her stuff, stole the little bit of money that she had saved up. They stole toys as well. This is the main bedroom. All the furniture is out because I moved, but they stole the roof sheets off, the lights off, the wires are ripped out. They ransacked everything. When it started, I just thought to myself, today I'm losing my life. When I saw them coming for me, the first reaction was, today I'm going to die. After a while, because it took so long, I was worried about my daughter and what would happen to her, say something would happen to me.
One Sunday morning, as I turned around, working in the kitchen, I saw them at the back door, pointing a gun at my husband's head. Then the guy with the gun, it was a pistol, he shot at my husband. And for some reason, and I believe that was the Lord that prevented them, that the bullets didn't strike him, because they went into the door right next to his face, and they were shooting from a very, very short distance, about half a meter. And to miss at that distance is quite incredible. So even the police couldn't believe that. 4 armed men came into the room with their balaclavas and their gloves. They took everything we had and they stuffed a dirty rag into Peter's mouth as he was lying on the floor, and he couldn't breathe because his nose was swollen by then because of the way they hit him on his head. And I said to them, please take out the rag and let him sit against the bed, otherwise he will suffocate and then you will kill him. You don't want to kill him.
It was 8 o'clock in the evening. We just finished having supper. My son went out. I asked him to go and close the garage. He went out and I heard a funny noise. And at first I thought it was my son playing with a dog or, you know, something like that. But I was a little bit worried. It sounded a little bit odd. So as I got to the garage, to the door to open it, it opened towards me and I faced a balaclava and a gun coming at me, which is terrifying. So I retreated, which I think most people instinctively will do. Luckily for us, the person didn't follow me. Gave me a little bit of time to regroup. So I retreated to the bedroom and I told my wife we were in big trouble. There were armed intruders coming into the house. So I opened the safe and got out my firearm and she tried to get the radio going. That minute felt like a very, very long time, you know, because you can hear this banging away and you don't know if your children are okay or what's going on. Through this little curtain that I was peeping, I could see this door fling open, and here came the first thug with my daughter with a firearm. If I'd been in the middle of that room with my firearm, he would have just just mowing me down. There's no way I would have been able to shoot him with my daughter in his arm. And by some miracle, they didn't see me. So I was in this tiny little corner with my firearm, and the first man with my daughter, with his arm around her neck and with a firearm, he walked straight past me, and like I say, at arm's length. And then a second man walked past, third man, two of them were armed, third one walked past, fourth one stopped. I think the room was full, there was no more space for them. They'd made my children and my wife lie down.
Well, to explore this further, I'm joined by Matlu Kalaba, who is a senior analyst with the Bureau for Food and Agricultural Policy. Thanks so much for joining us here on Africa Now.
It's a problem.
We've just heard some horrific stories of people who narrowly escape being killed. Of course, the statistics of farm murders is on the increase. Why are the police and the South African government not able to get a hold on this?
Well, I think the police and government, as you mentioned in general, is that they are struggling pretty much like most arms of government. I mean, we have the issue of electricity supply, which is one thing that, for more than 10 years, we knew this exists. So crime actually has been around and has been at the highest levels compared to other countries for that long, for more than 30 years as far as, the democracy goes.
As a result, the farming community has appealed to the international community for help. And one of the first countries to respond, and in fact, one of the only countries to respond, has been Russia. In your opinion, why have Western countries been so quiet?
So, The Western countries, and you're correct, we haven't heard quite a lot from them in response to crime in particular, but specifically with regards to farm murders. And I can speculate, but at one point I am aware that one of the organizations have made an appeal to the US, and they had a road trip basically to communicate this this scourge of farm murders and overall the crime in South Africa. But there hasn't been like a fiscal response or a diplomatic, political, or any kind of support. But to be fair, I'm not so sure the South African government or the police in particular have requested help in that. So the West has not responded in any way or form as far as we know.
And yet at the same time, we saw Russia responding to the point that we have up to 15,000 South African farmers actually in Russia who are busy farming there. In your opinion, why do you think Russia came forward and offered help?
I think one of the things that the South African farmers have been doing in the last 25 years or so is that they've been moving mainly across the continent, farming in as far as, West Africa, Nigeria, Benin, but majority in Southern Africa, Zambia. And there are a number of reasons, one being that I think the South African farmers are still deemed to be, some of the most experienced, some of the most skillful on the continent. I mean, you can judge by, South Africa's performance in as far as food security is concerned, competitiveness in global markets. And they are always keen, to explore other areas and other opportunities. And I think when Russia came, it was an opportunity for others, one, to obviously go somewhere where they wouldn't face the same kind of threat as we're talking about, but secondly, to apply their skills in a different environment. And therefore, Russia's response was just one of the ways in which it allowed people to make choices. But these are the kind of choices that they've been making in the past quarter century.
As I mentioned, there are at the moment up to 15,000 South African farmers in Russia. What negative impact has that had on South Africa?
I don't think that much of a negative impact has happened or would be there, in the sense that what we have observed over time, not only with the move to Russia or other parts of the continent, is that over time South African, number of commercial farmers have come to less than 40,000, 38,000 thereabout, from nearly 60,000. So we lost about one third of the commercial farmers. But in exchange, what happened was that you see those that are behind, they tend to expand their operation, they have access to more land, and the productivity levels have also increased in the recent decades. So that is a combination of factors. I think the other point that we're not talking about or we haven't mentioned that may be a contributing factor is that the land reform issues are still not fully resolved. And the discussions around the land reform make some parts or some part of the community uncomfortable.
For our audiences who don't understand, can you just give us a sense of what you mean when you say the land reform issues and where we stand with it in South Africa?
In brief, I would imagine the audience understand the political dynamics that took place in South Africa, you know, pre-democracy, pre-1994. But in a nutshell, most of the agricultural land, the land that is available and or suitable for farming, is owned by white commercial farmers. So that is a fact.
On some issue, is it significant that most of these farmers are white?
I think it is significant in the sense that it is not resolved. So it creates an uncertainty. So when you are not sure what would happen in the next 5 years or next 2 years, and agricultural activities in nature are capital intensive. You put money on the ground expecting return 5 years later. But if you don't know what will happen in the next 2 years, you wouldn't put your money on agricultural activities, be planting trees or putting fencing or any kind of capital. You would rather go somewhere where there is that assurance that in the next 5 or 10 years, you will still be working on that. So the uncertainty that is created by this lack of solution on the land reform, and if I may just mention a little bit, the arguments are still around in order to address the past injustices, if you like, where the minority in the population own majority of agricultural land. There are proposals that are populist in nature, that requires, or the notion is that the land needs to be expropriated, taken away from those who own it now, which majority are white, for no compensation at all. Now, that would make any person uncomfortable. If you have been farming or you grew up, you were born there, you've seen your parents and yourself putting money year after year on that land, and one day someone says, this needs to happen, it will make anyone uncomfortable, and it will take the next opportunity to kind of cover your losses or avoid them before they happen.
And yet at the same time, South Africa remains the main food exporter in the sub-Saharan Africa region. So the impact of these farmers leaving and the impact maybe of these farmers choosing another profession, for example, or not planting their crops, is felt beyond South Africa's borders.
That happens, and not only even from the production point of view, but we also are losing that international competitiveness in some of those areas. Because again, the other thing is that, you know, these kind of skills I'm talking about, these are not the kind of skills that you just transfer overnight over 2 years, but this is experiential learning from years and years. I mean, every time you lose, as you said, 15,000 farmers, you're not going to replace them with 20,000 skilled, capable, experienced. So there will be a transition, there will be a time lag, but we haven't gotten there yet. However, should it happen frequently and even in more numbers, that can, you know, can start to be a reality. And we have seen it, you know, with our neighbors on the northern border, that, you know, in insecurity, hunger, economic deprivation and lots of socio-economic unrest started with the issue or the issues around farming and agricultural policy being mishandled, in a nutshell.
I know when you talk about countries on our borders, if you're talking about land expropriation in Zimbabwe, for example, farms were taken away, but now they're actually given back because in the period that they were taken away from the white farmers, nothing happened to that land. So what is your response to something like that?
My response goes back to what I said earlier, that yes, recently farmers are getting back to the land, but the experience is not coming back. Zimbabwe is still a food deficit country in many ways. Even though some are coming back, even some skills are coming back, even the government is injecting, it will take a lot more time to go back to those levels than it did to destroy it. And that's actually a serious warning sign that you would think that these issues would send a message to any country that has a similar dynamic as we are. Namibia more or less has a similar situation as we do, but they're probably handling it differently. But you think that these kind of countries really would like to learn from the experience of what happened in Zimbabwe than go through their own, because you know the human suffering as a result of that is beyond any imagination, yet real.
Some of that experience is, when it comes to land expropriation, that it's not just a simple solution of taking farms away. But let's leave that discussion for one moment. I saw reports that Russia has gone from producing 100 to 150 million tons of grain this year, that in part is attributed to the South African farmers who are there. So that just talks to what we're discussing, the kind of contribution that they could make in South Africa. My question is that if the farm murders are not somehow dealt with, what is the long-term impact on South Africa?
The crime in general is not addressed. The society would really go to a worse state. I can't say how worse can it be or what form it will be, but certainly it's not the kind that everyone would like to see, the aspirations of Nelson Mandela and former leaders that fought this country for. It's not going in that direction that they wanted, unfortunately.
With farm murders on the increase, one of the questions, of course, is why is the South African government and police not doing more to stem the tide? We pose this question to people on both sides of the argument.
We first have to understand what is the attitude from government. I mean, if the president of the Republic of South Africa goes to New York and says on Bloomberg that there are no such things as farm murders and killings of farmers in South Africa, it means that he is actually telling a lie to the world, because his own police department gives the statistics of how many farmers are murdered annually and how many farm attacks occurs in South Africa.
We've had a couple of rural safety strategies been updated in the last 5, 6, 7 years from the police. But the action on the ground at the end of the day is not there, basically due to resources. The one big concern that we have is now the police budget has been cut by close to 2 billion rand.
The government came forward and the police department came forward with a national rural safety strategy. And they've launched that in 2019, which on paper is a good and an acceptable rural safety strategy. But it must be implemented. And that is where we have the problem. The resources from the police is not adequate, and it just stays as a document and say this is what should be done. But the situation is of such nature that we cannot only talk about what we should do, we must say what are we doing.
If you look at the statistics over the last 30 years that TLU has kept, and these are verified farm attacks and farm murders, we've had 1,811 white farmers and family members and visitors on farms being murdered, against 280 black people. That begs a question to be answered, whether it's racially or not. And then the other concern is obviously there was instances of farm attacks where there were actually racial accusations or threats made to the people. Not on all of them, but there were some. And the other concern is that you have people, political people, speaking from podiums, actually stirring up these racial tensions and saying, we must attack these guys, we must murder these guys. So there's no definitive answer whether it's racial or not, but there is a big possibility.
The impact of these farm murders is felt far beyond South Africa. As more farms are vacated and the land lies fallow, there's less produce to feed people. South Africa is the main food exporter in the region, which means that this has a direct impact on food security in sub-Saharan Africa. Brilin Shatunge is a Zimbabwean farmer who says, and I quote her, "If we kill the farming community, we kill mankind, because people cannot live without food."
I don't know who's going to be feeding everyone, because, I mean, if we kill the farming community, we've basically killed livelihood. We've killed mankind, because you know you cannot do without food. It's a basic human right, food. This problem that I'm seeing in South Africa is just not in isolation. As you can see what's been happening in Mozambique, in DRC, the insurgencies, that is also very worrisome, because people are constantly having to run for their lives. Because, and how do we scale up in agriculture if every time you need to now run for your life? We're blessed with everything, the human capital, the resources, the wonderful land, wonderful weather, wonderful everything, but with what is going on, we are not united. I host a lot of little kids that come over. We talk about different visions, Vision 2050, 2063, and Millennium Goals, Zero Hunger by 2030. But how are we going to arrive to that if we're constantly having to murder the person that is actually going to help you achieve that that goal? This has to stop, and the time for it to stop is now. Equally, we are talking about silencing the guns, but are we silencing the guns? No, we're not. It's almost as if we are saying, trigger. Put your hands on the trigger. People are being slaughtered, and we've got masses, we've got all sorts of things, and it's actually happening in the communities, and that's really affecting food security. So we're going to remain food insecure for quite a long time. So we really have to, like, now go back to the drawing board and see how we can actually try and come up together and do a proper strategic planning and see how we can protect the person called a f-. We have one common denominator, the stomach. And the stomach doesn't care about your political views. It doesn't care what color you are. It only cares about one thing, and that one thing is the food, is food. And if we don't support the big farmer, the commercial farmer, and protect them, then we have a problem. Because then we're not going to be able to have enough food to feed the people. The big farmer, the commercial farmer, can also be very helpful and instrumental in helping the smallholder farmer and the ones that want to go into the agriculture sector to help them. But how do they help them if they are scared and constantly having to run, bolt their doors, get this firearm, get that? So every time when you're driving around, what do you see? The first thing you see is a firearm that a person is carrying. And that shows you that there's a problem. Because if there was no problem, we would not be carrying firearms. I've got to a point where I have to carry firearms myself. Why are we carrying them? But because of this problem that is there. So I think it's time that we actually ask again one more time to the governments, all 55 countries, to say, this has to stop. And it has to stop now. Food is very important.
As farm murders increase and become more brutal, farmers and communities feel the need to take matters into their own hands. Self-defense and weapons training are on the rise, to the extent that it's now become commonplace for most people living in rural communities to carry a gun. Arti was invited to observe one such training session.
During that day, we will go into specific training with the farmer, the family, and the neighbors. And the first aspect of the training will be how to use a firearm, how to use it in and around the house. We also give them specific training according to South African legislation of how and when you can shoot when someone is attacking you or your family or even your neighbor. We then take it further and we give them training with regards to first aid. If someone in your house is shot, if your neighbor is shot, what to do to keep that person alive until the ambulance arrives. We then also issue them with a digital radio, but we cannot simply issue them with a digital radio and let them be. We actually give them training in how to exactly utilize this radio. In the end, we want all of these farmers and their neighbors to have an effective communication network. And this network must be broadened as time goes by to give them the opportunity to speak to each other and to tell them each other when they're safe and when they're not. Farmers started noticing that they are their own first responder. The police are not going to arrive within a few minutes after you dispatch them to come and assist you. Most of the cases, the police don't even have vehicles available to do that. So the farmers and people in the cities and towns started organizing themselves into community safety structures, and we assist with that. We have approximately 170 now on a national level, and we give further support to these structures, being legal advice, legal support, being it issue logistical support, administrative support, to help communities safeguard themselves and to help communities on the rural area where the farms are to safeguard themselves as well. Our concern is, however, if you're hungry, you will go into a farm, take the food, maybe take money and go away. Why stay in 20% of the matters and torture the people? The torture is coupled with hate crime. There's no doubt about that.
Well, that brings us to the end of this show and the end of 2022. From the team here at Africa Now, we look forward to investigating, sharing, and exploring Africa with you in the new year to come. Until then, stay safe.